Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another FIA Group webinar. I am your host. Yes, I am your host. This is Adam Russo, the co-founder and CEO of the FIA Group. I missed the last two webinars, and based on all the emails I've received, it seems like all of you out there are happy that I wasn't around. You actually like the fact that the webinars were better with me not being on them. Well, I really don't care what any of you think, because I am back, and you're not going to get rid of me again. I will be here this time and next time as well. But hopefully everyone is enjoying their summer, and I'm hoping that no one's blind today after looking at that solar eclipse yesterday. Ron told me yesterday that he actually looked up without the glasses on.
Yeah.
And I did not look up without the glasses on, so I felt I needed to go outside and look up at the sun. I'm like, if Ron's going to go blind, I'll be blind with him. That's the decision I made yesterday. So I did it.
Thank you.
I have a bunch of spots I'm seeing. But you look a lot better with spots on my eyes. Ron.
Yeah,
for whatever
yeah.
reason, you're a better looking guy today. Anyways, with me as always is Ron Peck. Say hello, Ron.
Hello, Ron.
In addition to that, we have Brady Bizarro, who is our DC insider. Say hello, Brady.
Hello.
And as always, our number one most requested speaker. For some reason, everyone just seems to like her more than all the rest of us combined. Your approval ratings are outstanding. I mean, Ron and I are getting 1 or 2 stars, and you're getting 4 or 5 stars every single time. But we have Jen McCormick with us here as well. Say hello, Jen.
Hello.
So we're really excited today. We expect this one to be fun because, really, this one's about stories. That's what this is about. It's a true impact on the bottom line, identifying current issues, implementing solutions, and seeing results. These are basically horror stories that turn into success stories, things that we've seen across over the past month, or actually 2 months. We've actually been gathering these stories for a little while. Just stuff that has come to our desks that we said, you know what, this would be a great topic, great story for our webinar. Obviously, we removed and changed all names, names of companies, names of patients, changed the dollar amounts. But I can guarantee you, most of you on this call probably have had a situation similar to these stories. So we're going to talk about what we did, how we resolved it, but most importantly, how we ensured that you, as the client and as the plan, never had this problem happen again. We urge all of you to please follow us on LinkedIn. We're very proud of the number of followers we have. We want them to continue to increase. Our social media, we have a social media person here at the FIA Group, Matt Payton, whose job basically hinges on whether or not we get followers. So if you want him to be fired, feel free to unfollow us. If you want to give him a raise and get him to pretty much have job security, well, follow us on FIA Group LinkedIn page. Go to see us on Facebook and just search for the FIA Group and tell everyone how much you like us. By the way, Ron, I wanted to give you a kudos on the story you had written about you in Money, Inc. I mean, the story that you wrote in Money, Inc. It was a great, great article.
Thanks.
Next, please check out our podcast. So now, how many podcasts have we done now? 16 podcasts. And what we've noticed is anytime Ron and I are not doing the podcast together, no one listens.
It's true.
It is what it is. It's just been amazing since Ron, Ron and I, I've heard the term the car guys. People compared us to the car guys. I'm like, I hope I have that many people listening. But what we have not done in the past, which we are planning to do now, and I explained this to Matt this morning, is we really haven't pushed the people to follow us by going on the Apple podcast. Why? Well, we just wanted to see if it worked. We wanted to see if people would like it. We wanted to see if our producer that we have internally, if he would continue to do it, if Brady would bring something to the table, which he has, Jen and the rest of the team has. So we want to make it official. We will continue these podcasts until people just stop listening to us. So we urge you again, feel free to find us online. Go to Apple Podcasts, search for the FIA Group, find us and follow us because we really want those numbers to keep going up. Anything else I want to bring up? Oh, really quick. So our discussion yesterday was on reference-based pricing. A lot of people are talking about it. So we basically have a podcast right now to the hundreds of you are on this call. If you want to learn more about reference-based pricing, not from a sales position standpoint, but just telling you what it's about, what we're seeing, the differences between the different ways to do it, in about 20 minutes, if you listen to that podcast, for a total of 20 minutes, you'll know everything you need to know to start looking at those potential options for yourselves, your clients, and for fellow people in the industry. Okay, proof is in the pudding. I am very proud of this. I want to make sure we keep telling people about this. because it's an important selling point here at the company. And I used Matt as an example yesterday when I talked to the staff about this. I'm going to use him again. A single person, which Matt is, on our plan pays $127.62 a month for health insurance. Zero copay for generics and urgent care. We always get people saying, well, what's your out-of-pocket max? What's the deductible? There is none. You're covered day one. A single person in Massachusetts, on average, pays $554 with a $25 copay for generics and urgent care. So what we pay versus what the state of Massachusetts, a single person would pay, is literally 25%. That's a big deal. The family plan, myself, my wife, and our four children are on the FIA family plan, $357 a month. Same exact numbers for the copay and the urgent care. Family plan in Massachusetts, $1,320 a month. People ask me all the time, how do we do this? Really easy. Everything that we tell, that we preach to all of you on a daily basis, on a weekly basis or a monthly basis or at conferences, webinars, whatever, we preach this to our employees every day. They are sick of hearing my voice. They are sick of hearing Ron's voice and Jen's. But I can promise you, our employees care about the cost of care for one simple reason. They're incentivized to do so. If you want to know more about how we do it, feel free to contact any of us about how we do it. Now, the actual cost. What we actually spend per employee per year is $5,858 for their healthcare spending. The normal cost for an employee in this region, which is New England, is almost $12,000. Based on our employer size, which is 200, it's $10,500. And in our industry, which is the consulting industry, it's again almost $11,000. We are close to half of the spend of what a typical company. You know, people say, well, Adam, all you do is hire young, good-looking, healthy people. Have you seen Ron and myself? We are not young. We might be good-looking, but we're not the healthiest either. Right, Ron?
Life's worn us down, Adam.
Right. We've worn each other down, Ron. Ron's had over 10 years in this company. I've had over 17. We are both worn out. We're like horses that need to just be sent to the glue factory. But the reason we're able to do this is basically two reasons. One, we care about the cost of care, and then we incentivize our employees through our handbook design and our employee benefit plan to do just that. So let's go right into it. I talked about who our speakers were today. Myself, Ron Peck, Jim McCormick, and Brady. Brady has obviously taken a much bigger role. As long as we have something to talk about when it comes to Obamacare, Trump Care, the repeal and replace, or the skinny repeal, whatever you want to call it, until that ends, Brady will be on these webinar, so stop telling us to kick him off and to bring Chris Aguiar back. Chris is on a sabbatical. I think he's coming back for, what, 6-9 months, something like that?
Yeah, he's doing the subrobatical.
He's doing the subrobatical. He's focused on the subrogation work for now. So real quick on the agenda, political update with Brady. We're going to do a FAQ, frequently asked questions in PGC, and then we're going to get right into the burning issues, the winners and the losers, RBP, twice-based claims, getting to yes, fiduciary comes through, The Leave of Absence Blues. That's like a soap opera on ABC at 3 o'clock. Everyone here used to watch General Hospital, right?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, how great was that show? I loved it. And then a stop-loss hold in the bag. So, with that, Brady, please don't bore these folks too long. Try to get through these slides as quick as you can. I doubt any of these hundreds of people are actually on this to listen to you. But with that being said, tell us what's going on in D.C., buddy.
Well, thanks, Adam. So I want to pick up where we left off last time in the repeal and replace saga. You may recall there's been a lot of activity on the Hill recently. There was a dramatic vote, which I'll talk about in a second. But basically, the thing to know here is that Republicans are in a pretty bad spot. They haven't really been able to make good on their 7-year promise to repeal and replace Obamacare. There's been tons of pressure coming in on them from the White House, from Senate leaders, conservative and Republicans, moderate Republicans, interest groups. Everybody seems to want action on Obamacare, but they can't agree on what to do. Remember, the House passed their bill, the American Health Care Act. The Senate had a version, the Better Care Reconciliation Act. All these different pieces of legislation ultimately failed. The Republicans were not able to agree on a couple sticking points. One of them included the Medicaid expansion piece and the issue of waivers for protections for those with pre-existing conditions and essential health benefits. You had some senators try to scramble and offer amendments to get a bill that could pass. And then what we saw on the night this all went down in flames was this version of a bill called the Skinny Repeal, which literally was the Republicans lowering the bar more and more such that they had a bill unveiled 2 hours before that only repealed the unpopular parts of the ACA, got rid of the mandate. The employer mandate was gone for 8 years. They permitted the use of waivers. They increased the limits on contributions to HSAs. They repealed some of the most unpopular parts of taxes in the ACA. They didn't even touch Medicaid. It was literally a shell of a bill designed just to get some debate going between the House and the Senate. And that was the point we were at. We had 8 hours of debate left on the night that this bill was considered. And as I said, most of the details were kept secret. And you had the president tweeting all along the way saying, look, if you can't pass what you're working on now, get something done. We'll repeal now. We'll replace later. Worry about it then. So most of you probably weren't watching the fireworks on the Senate floor, but rest assured I was. I was doing the C-SPAN late Thursday into Friday morning, watching literally, you know, some of the most dramatic things you'd see on Capitol Hill. At least for me, it was very exciting. But typically you never see a Senate leader bring a bill to the floor when he doesn't have the votes. And Mitch McConnell here, the Senate leader, took a gamble. He knew he essentially didn't have two votes of the moderate Senators Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, Susan Collins from Maine, but he figured he had John McCain in the bag, that he'd come around. They even brought the vice president over from the White House to sort of partake in the negotiations with John McCain. But what happened was at one point you had a group of senators huddled around Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins. Actually, it was Democrats who were sort of walling them off so that Republicans couldn't get to them to get their vote. And then you had John McCain sort of pacing back and forth. He disappeared into the cloakroom various times with the vice president. At one point, there was a shot on CNN of him holding a phone. Apparently, the president had called him and said, John, you know, please don't do this, or something to that effect. And this dramatic moment occurred, you know, I think after 1 a.m. when you see the majority leader in the middle with his arms folded, and McCain came over to the front. It gave me chills, frankly. It was a big, big moment for Republicans. I mean, he came to the front and gave the thumbs down and said no. I mean, at that point, there was a shriek from the Republican side, and the Democrats on the other side sort of celebrated. But that was it. That was the moment where, for now, repeal and replace has collapsed. And some people think that McCain, you know, wanted to stick it to the president. Maybe he, you know, his official statement said that he didn't believe in this bill, that it was a shell of a bill, and that Republicans can do better. And so where does that leave us now? What are our lessons learned from all this? Well, lesson one is, without a clear plan, repeal and replace is not going to happen. You need to have Republicans on board here with what they're going to have in a repeal and replace bill. Are they going to be able to reform and roll back the Medicaid expansions? What will happen to those people who have pre-existing conditions, who rely on coverage? What will happen to essential health benefits? And it's this fundamental divide between those who want more government and less government, more regulation from Obamacare in terms of what coverage mandates are in place, what taxes are in place, and those who want to see a little bit more free market involved. And you really just can't get past this issue, especially when you have to get 50 votes to get something to pass. Lesson two, taking away benefits is hard. We know this in our industry, too. And frankly, it's true of all politics. Once you give people benefits, it's hard to say, hey, we're going to take that back. And that was a problem Republicans faced when it came to the Medicaid expansion. Third issue here, addressing cost is hard. And we rant and rave about this all the time. The ACA itself didn't really even address cost. And this versions of these bills that were proposed also didn't. This is entirely about access to coverage, right? Getting number of people, getting more people covered and declaring victory. And frankly, it was perceived as such in the media that these bills were just reducing the number of people who were covered, and then also including some tax breaks for wealthy people. That's sort of how it was portrayed in the media. It was pretty hard to get out from under that wet blanket for Republicans. But addressing cost is much more difficult than addressing access to care, and that'll be the case going forward. The last two here, passing a bill in secret doesn't work. I mean, we had webinars, you know, for months trying to divulge parts of the bills as they became known to us, but majority of this bill was written in secret on the Senate side especially, and so what it would mean for employers and for the insurance industry at large was really unknown. Typically, this kind of legislation at this size, you'd have input from experts, you'd have witness testimony, you'd have committee hearings, and none of that was done. In the name of just trying to get this pushed through quickly, it all fell apart. The last and most important lesson, perhaps, of all, is that repeal and replace is still not dead. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, if you've been watching or following Twitter at all, you'll see that the president has been tweeting about, hey, he wants to get this done, get back to work, Mitch McConnell. Republicans campaigned for this on 7 years. And so I think the idea that this is not going to happen is a pipe dream. I think some version is going to reemerge. It's like that zombie that just won't die in the Walking Dead series. You know, it's like it just keeps coming back more and more. And so what's the road ahead? Where are we going from here? What do we think the next actions will be that Republicans will take? Well, for now, I think it's safe to say that repeal and replace is put on ice. Republicans are wanting to move on to other issues, tax reform, infrastructure, a lot of things they can't really get to until they deal with health care. And so you see a tension now within the party where some people are trying to move on and the president is saying, no, wait a minute, there's still work to do. He called out the Senate Majority Leader personally a number of times, which is pretty rare to see in politics these days. But he tweeted out, can you believe Mitch McConnell, who was screened repeal and replace for 7 years, couldn't get it done. So I think a lot of pressure will be continued to exert it on Mitch McConnell, and we'll see if another version.
He might go blind, too. He looked at the sun yesterday.
I did see that. Yeah, the president looked up.
He might have more problems. Just to make sure we're on the same page.
I mean, but do we expect anything less, to be honest? We all knew he would do that. So what we'll look for now going forward is Congress is on vacation. They're on the August recess. They're home raising money. They're who knows doing what. But if a bill does emerge, we can expect it will probably go through the committee process, which I would call regular order, you know, because this other process didn't work for them the first time. The ACA remains the law of the land. I mean, that's the reality here. We have some unknown questions, some questions that we have to answer still, but for the most part, the ACA remains in place. What are those unknowns? Well, it's about executive enforcement of the ACA. That's the issue we turn to now. And the president has made some intimations on Twitter and elsewhere that he maybe will withhold subsidies for people on the individual market. He might end the cost-sharing reductions to insurance companies. Remember, those are essentially subsidies that are paid by the government to insurance companies to subsidize the cost of care for those low-income people who are on the Obamacare exchanges. And so someone, for example, someone making $17,000 a year who pays $50 a month for a silver plan is going to have their out-of-pocket max cap at $600 because of these cost-sharing reductions. If those were to be ended, they could find themselves paying the typical out-of-pocket max, which we know is $7,150 for this year. So they're pretty important to many people. And for now, the government has funded them in August, but going forward, it's unclear if that'll be the case. A few last deadlines here I want to mention. September 4th, the Senate is going to have hearings on the individual market, because for now, while we can't get an agreement on perhaps a comprehensive health care bill, at least there's some bipartisan agreement that they should at least try to stabilize the individual insurance markets. So we'll look for the hearings to start on those. The end of the month in September, insurers have to make final decisions about selling ACA plans and what those rates will be, because come November, the government wants to have open enrollment begin for the exchanges, and they need to have all the posting done for the rate information by that time. So those are the drop-dead dates that we're looking at. The issue of the CSRs, though, the cost-sharing reductions, is going to be a big one to follow in the coming weeks. And again, about the mandates, will the president choose to enforce the employer mandate? That applies to us. We'll be watching to see if he has anything to say about those issues going forward. Now I'll turn it over to Jen.
All right, thanks. So the important thing to take away from that is that ACA is still in place. So when it comes to questions that are coming in, the law as it existed still exists today. So nothing has changed. When it comes time for renewal, which we should be talking about the next couple of months, everything that was in effect is still in effect, particularly those SBC templates that we've talked about. So some of the questions that we saw this past month, number one is whether or not a plan could exclude claims where a patient was discharged against medical advice, and or whether or not they were acting in noncompliance of a physician's orders, would it be okay to exclude claims in those instances? And after reviewing the situation and things like this that were similar, it is certainly not our recommendation to exclude claims where a patient is discharged against medical advice or is acting in noncompliance with a physician's order. Not only would this be something that is difficult to administer, it would be hard to tell on a case-by-case basis what the specific instructions from a physician were or when or how they were released against medical advice. But more importantly, it could be problematic in the sense that this would be considered against public policy and that you are acting contrary to the patient's right to make their own decisions. So this is definitely not an exclusion that we would recommend to put in your document. Second, does coverage of a domestic partner necessarily also entail coverage of a domestic partner's dependent child? Guess what? It depends. So in general, in order for you to have language that would allow for this to happen, the language needs to be in the document. Whatever it is that the plan wants to require should be specifically outlined and detailed in the plan. And the other thing to keep in mind is that certain state laws dictate how domestic child and stepchildren are aligned. So in a state, for example, in Massachusetts, if the plan covers domestic child or covers stepchildren, then they'll also need to cover a child of a domestic partner as well. So you need to take a look at that on a case-by-case basis, but more importantly, the language is going to be what dictates who and what is going to be covered under the dependent provision. Last but not least is whether or not it's compliant with health care reform for a plan to have deductibles for certain types of situations, like an accident deductible. And the answer to that is, it depends. And the thing to keep in mind, particularly for a non-grandfathered plan, is that the ACA rule dictates that all in-network benefits for essential health benefits count towards the out-of-pocket maximum. So if you have a separate accident deductible, it could be compliant as long as that would count towards or accrue towards the combined maximum out-of-pocket. So you need to look at that on a case-by-case basis and make sure that you would not be excluding that from the overall out-of-pocket max. And I'll turn it back over to Brady. Ron.
It's actually Ron.
Sorry.
Yeah, my turn.
My turn.
All right.
So it's time to start with the stories. Gather around, boys and girls. You might be shocked or surprised to learn that the first story relates to reference-based pricing. You know, I was actually thinking, guys, if my middle name was Benjamin or Brandon, my initials would be RBP. Would that not have been amazing?
Yeah. You still do it.
Yeah, I guess that's legal. In this scenario, and the scenarios we'll be discussing with you now, the stories, first thing we're going to do is we're going to go through the fact patterns. Then we're going to talk about an example where somebody did something that was either reactive. We call them deep losers, but I don't want anyone to feel bad, especially if you feel like this might be about you. It's not, but. And then we'll go through the people who took action preemptively, and we call those the winners. And you'll start to see the same kind of pattern forming. That pattern being that you're examining your contracts, your plan documents, educating the people who are impacted, the participants, the providers ahead of time. Keep that in mind as we go through the stories. So in the first story, what we have here is a patient who was seen inpatient at a hospital. The claims were paid by the plan at a reference-based pricing rate of Medicare plus 40%. The provider actually filed an appeal with the plan and also balance billed the patient at the same time. Again, a fact pattern that if you haven't actually experienced yourself, I'm sure you've heard about. So in the first example, the reactive example, what we ended up seeing was sort of a plan document that had a traditional UNC section in the plan document. It indicated that the usual customary for out-of-network providers is based on the charged amounts of providers of similar treatment type in the area. And it didn't reference Medicare Plus. It did reference RBP. And what ends up happening is the patient was actually counseled by the provider to appeal to the plan as well. So now you have both the plan, the provider, and the patient appealing to the plan. They demand a copy of the plan document. They see that the Medicare Plus rationale that was applied here is not reflected in the plan document. So, of course, they file claims against the plan. Not only are the claims payable, but they accuse the plan of breaching its fiduciary duty. That being that the plan went and processed claims completely outside the terms of the plan document, which they decided was arbitrary and capricious. So, moral of the story there, obviously, the first thing that they missed is that they didn't adjust the plan document accordingly. Now, what did I tell you? What are the things that you're going to see not only in this story but other stories? Plan documents, education, forethought. So, in this example of a winner, same exact fact pattern, but in this case, what ended up happening was the plan document had been changed, did reflect the actual Medicare Plus methodology. Additionally, it also threatened to revoke the assignment of benefits if the provider wasn't willing to accept the payment as payment in full. Also note, that impacts the provider's ability to appeal to the plan in the first place. Additionally, the patient was advised about the plan's methodology before they even visited the provider. So when the provider is balance billing the patient and saying, hey, appeal to the plan, hey, let's file a claim against the plan, the patient was already on the plan side of things. They understood the way the program works. They knew who to call. And who do they call? Their advocate, the education, advocacy. What are we talking about? Looking into the hospital's 501c3 status, filing the patient's rights for financial aid under 501R.
What that means is the hospital is a nonprofit. That's when Ron says 501c3, that's what he means. And there's two reasons why that's important. One, if they accept Medicare or Medicaid from anybody, and they're a nonprofit facility, and that patient can and could receive financial aid, meaning they're not that rich, then there's a limit to how much they can balance bill, if even have the ability to balance bill at all.
So it what ends up happening here, and we saw recently a news article where a hospital that was not complying with its 501R obligations actually lost its 501c3 status. So these are real threats that we're leveling against these providers. Ultimately, at the end of the day, we're not saying what the provider is or isn't allowed to charge. What we're doing is we're making it so costly, so inconvenient for the provider to balance bill the patient and file these appeals. They do a cost-benefit analysis. They're better off just taking what the plan is going to pay and taking it as payment in full. So it's all about that disincentivizing it rather than telling them what they can and can't do. So, again, in this instance, we were able to get the matter resolved.
So really quick, I want to make sure people understand. This doesn't just have to do with reference-based pricing companies and vendors and actual RVP plans. This is a problem. Can you go to the slide before? I know I'm doing something crazy here. But I am back after 2 months, so but it would be a little nuts. Reference-based pricing on this slide right here. This happens more than not. This occurs not by a reference-based pricing vendor, but just on a claim negotiating company. Claims negotiating companies on their own decide to pay a claim based on Medicare pricing, and there was UNT language in the SPD. We're seeing more and more now. More RVP vendors are actually smart enough now because they've been working with us for a long time. Most plans and brokers at least know now, okay, if I'm going to do reference-based pricing for all the claims, I need reference-based pricing in the plan doc. This is still a major problem for those vendors that are just negotiating claims as well. So really quick, before Ron gets to this bonus round, it's important to understand a couple things. One, at the beginning of any reference-based pricing program, we recommend you get your stop-loss carrier to keep claims open. Allow for an extension. Whether it's 6 months, a year, whatever it is, get them up at the beginning. Make sure they're aware of that situation. Have them be educated. Next, get a negotiation range from the stop-loss carrier. Ask them, hey, our plan doc says Medicare plus 150, but we're able to play around a little bit with that number, go up to 180 or 190. Get the stop-loss carrier to agree in writing that if you pay up to 200 or up to 190, they're not going to push back, they're not going to penalize you, or they're not going to try to increase premium. I just had a call today with the plan whose plan doc said 150. They paid the claims at 250. Stop loss said, okay, we'll reimburse you, but 12% increase in premium for the remainder of the year. That's the type of discussion you need to have, not 6 months in, but prior to signing that contract. Next, and probably most importantly, in every single one of these situations, you want to, when Ron brought up the whole thing, 501R, 501C3, the whole process you're supposed to do, great. The problem we still have is, what happens if they don't listen to you? We see it all the time. Ron and myself are calling an attorney. They don't call back. And then one of our clients or someone's going to say, hey, guys, why haven't you resolved it yet? It's like, I can't force someone to call me back. It's like when I was in high school. You call the girl up, and if her mother answers the phone and says she wasn't there, she wasn't there. I couldn't talk to her. I couldn't force her to talk to me. It never actually happened to me, but I'm just saying.
Hypothetical.
But the point I'm trying to make is, that's the example. We can't force someone. The only way we can force someone's hand is to sue them. So have that discussion with the plan and the broker up front. Okay, guys, Medicare plus 150. At what point, at what dollar range, do we just say, you know what? We're going to sue you. A declaratory action to make you prove that your charges are reasonable. At what dollar point? What type of claim? That needs to be discussed with a tad up front, because otherwise it's just going to cause problems, because many people think, what do you mean they haven't responded? It's something that needs to be discussed. It's a burning issue in our industry, and it just happened again today, so I thought I'd bring it up. Ron?
No, that's a great point, Adam, and those are things, if you think about it, right, first of all, getting the provider to react, and second, having stop loss have your back. Those are also two things that, in a lot of ways, are addressed by this slide, where if you're able to execute a direct contract or take access to a narrow network, that benefits you in a couple ways there. One, stop loss is more secure in knowing that you now have a negotiated rate in place, so that worst comes to worst, if people go to that facility, that's the maximum the plan is going to have to pay. So there's a little bit less questioning or doubt or ambiguity in what you're paying. And secondly, when you talk about the provider, A lot of providers will come back and argue that the rate you're offering them is unfair, that they can't operate profitably at that rate. But if you can show them that their competition, an equivalent facility that offers the same type of services, has agreed to accept that rate as payment in full, that naturally begs the question, if they can do it, why can't you? Finally, a lot of, I think, employers, when it comes to people being balance billed, they worry about the balance billing because with an initial sort of startup reference-based pricing plan where there is no direct contract, there is no narrow network, they're basically telling their employees, it doesn't matter where you go, you're going to be balance billed. But if you have these safe harbors, you have these centers of excellence where you can send people, and they choose to go elsewhere and they get balance billed, that employer feels a little bit more empowered to say, listen, I'm sorry you're being balance billed, I'll do what I can to help you, but ultimately, you made this decision, you decided to go outside my narrow network. So looking at another story where there's some conflict, and Adam, you actually started to lead into this issue of stop loss and conflicts between stop loss and the plan, and I'm sure everybody has seen something like this. We certainly have. You have a situation where the plan received a large claim. They either paid based on what they thought was UNC, or they paid based on a network contract or a direct contract. Whatever the reason, they priced it at a certain amount and paid it. They submit everything beyond their deductibles to stop loss. Stop loss goes and on their own, with their own independent auditor, reviews the claims and decides that the plan overpaid.
We're seeing way more of this.
I call it the tough love.
I had 6 cases last week, all relating to independent stop loss audits, where based on my review, I never saw anything in the policy that allowed them to audit the claim in the first place. But that's another issue for another day. Keep going.
I'm actually glad you bring that up because, you know, in the example of the loser, Adam, when they were confronted by this tough love scenario, we ended up getting it after the fact. We looked at the stop loss policy, and it basically says, dear policyholder, we have the right to completely ignore your plan document, hire our own auditing firm, and decide what's payable and not.
Right, so yours is totally, that's way worse than the ones I'm talking about, because in ours, there was no audit right. In this one, it gave them the right to audit.
Oh, yeah.
They did, which they should do.
Read the contract.
Right.
So unfortunately, you know, in that scenario, what we ended up doing for them, and it's not on the slide, but what we ended up doing is we actually went back to the provider and tried to negotiate down the claim. Certainly, I think the amount that was negotiated down wasn't equal to what the plan was hoping to get from stop loss, but pretty brought it much, much closer to their deductible. So it wasn't as good as stop loss, but it was the best they were going to get. But that, again, that was putting out the fire after it had already started. Talking about somebody who instead is putting the smoke detectors around the house and detecting the fire before it even starts and nipping it in the bud, let's talk about the winner. Same exact fact pattern, but in this case, we looked at the stop loss policy. The representative of this particular carrier told us that their policy said a certain thing, the stuff that you saw in that last slide, that they're allowed to independently audit the claims and decide what's payable. When we looked at the policy that had been issued to this particular plan, that language wasn't there. This caused some confusion. An audit was done. They went back and realized that during the underwriting process, this particular plan had negotiated with this carrier to have that language removed in exchange for updating their plan document with tougher pricing language. So basically, they met at a middle ground. And it turns out that after doing a review based on the plan document's terms, the amount that was paid by the plan was equal to the payable amount.
Hey, really quick before we turn it over to Jen, I want to bring up something. You mentioned audit firms. And people go, oh, yeah, we hired an audit firm, a clinical audit firm. Folks, I've been lucky enough over the past many, many years to actually look at different clinical audits. I've always just glanced at them. You know, I'm not a doctor, okay? I'm not a surgeon. But recently, I've just for whatever reason, I guess I'm bored, right? I got nothing else going on. I've been reading them. And what I noticed is, depending on which company you work with, not all clinical reviews are the same. There is some definite, much better ones out there, and there's some companies that are really bad. So it's less about whether or not the audit firm agrees or disagrees with your position. It's why they agree or disagree with your position, I think, that matters. I had a case I'm working on right now. I think, Jen, you and I actually have a call later on today about it, where an audit firm did one review, said it's payable. Another audit review did the second review and said it was not payable.
Right.
And if you just look at the two reviews, there's no question the one that said not to review it, 25 pages, much more authority, many more references, much more reason if as just like layperson go, wow, oh, wow, wow, I can see why they're denied, versus a 3-page report as to why to pay. That didn't really have as many outside sources or references. So again, not all reviews are the same. Don't just do it based on the price. Does it sound familiar? Don't pick a stop-loss carrier based on the premium.
What?
Same thing when it comes to clinical reviews. So, turn it over to you, Jen. Bye.
All right.
Everyone's excited. Everyone's jumping in. Everyone's all pumped that Jen's back.
Getting to yes, right? That's the example we're going to talk about. All right, so here's the facts. There's a broker, and a broker has a group that's a larger employer group, and they're tired of seeing these increases in premiums year after year with their current fully insured plan. They're looking to make a move. They want to go self-funded. So their broker, proactive broker, decides that she's going to submit an RFP to a bunch of different TPAs to see what options might be available for this group to move from fully insured to self-funding. One of the specific questions, among other questions, since this group, being new to the self-funding world, has some concerns. There are some things that maybe as a fully insured plan they didn't have to worry about, claims, appeals, making decisions, how the administrative fees and costs would work. They have some concerns they want to make sure that are addressed as part of their transition to a self-funded plan. So a question I asked is whether or not a TPA would serve as a fiduciary for them. So those are the facts. So instead of talking about winners and losers, I like to make people feel empowered. I like to make my child feel empowered. So instead of saying yes or no, I say make a good choice or make a different choice. So that's the verbiage I'm going to use here. So making a bad choice, make a different choice. So the first TPA they went to said, as far as serving as a fiduciary, are you kidding? No way. This is not written in my ASA. This is not how we operate. This is not something that we can work in the function as. This is not something that we have built in as our process and how we are handling claims and appeals to be something we can handle for you. So it's a no-go. Option number two, they move to a second TPA. And this TPA says yes. But how can they say yes? A TPA is not a fiduciary. How can they make this something that's part of their administrative process? Well, the first thing that they did is they said, all right, so looking at our current template, our current documents, there's going to be two levels of appeal that you're going to be handling when you're moving from fully insured to self-funded. When it comes to those two levels of appeals, I, as the TPA, I'm going to help you with the first level of appeal. I'm going to make sure that the language in the document is going to outline that when it comes time for this initial appeal to come in, I got you. I'm going to look at the plan document. I'm going to look at the facts. I'm going to help you to make this decision. I'm going to help you to respond to that first initial appeal. And as compensation for making that decision, I'm going to add a little bit something extra to my TPA admin fee. That's great. But like I said, there's going to be two levels of appeals. So while the TPA is handling the first level of appeal, who's going to handle the second level of appeal? The TPA at that point didn't necessarily feel comfortable to handle that level of appeal. So what did they do? They reached out to us, and they asked us to purchase the PACE service. And if you haven't heard of PACE, you don't know about PACE, immediately call Tim Callender and ask him for some more information about that. But as part of the PACE service, what it is that we can do is we can take the fiduciary responsibility when it comes to that second level appeal, that final level appeal. So instead of leaving that something that the group is stuck with as far as making a decision about something, especially for a group that was previously fully insured, has no experience how the process works, how to make these decisions. They're in the business of making shoes or making jeans or whatever it is they're in the business of. They're not here to decide how to handle claims. This is not what their expertise is. This is not where it lies. So why not outsource this decision-making and not have to worry about that as part of their function of being self-funded? Instead, they can focus on saving money and cutting costs and working with someone who can handle that on their behalf. So this obviously was the best choice for this group. This group transitioned smoothly from fully insured to self-funding, not having to worry about these claims and appeals issues and becoming a fiduciary when it comes to making these appeals decisions, because they put these two layers in place so they could feel protected, have the benefits of self-funding without the worries or off the risk, which was really exciting for them. So I think I'm going to turn it back over to Ron to talk about some more fiduciary funds.
Nice. So this story, speaking of fiduciary, is called Fiduciary Comes Through. It sounds like the title of an episode of Thomas and Friends. So as far as the facts are concerned, basically very simple fact pattern. Everyone's seen this one before. You have a claim. It comes in. It's denied. It's appealed. It's denied again. It comes in for a final appeal, and lo and behold, denial is overturned and the claims are paid. It hits the spec deductible. They submit it to stop loss. Stop loss says, where'd you come to that decision? Deny. And so what ends up happening in the first example, the stop loss, after denying the claim for reimbursement submitted by the plan, they question the plan. They say, listen, when you first got the claim, you denied it. When you got your first appeal, you denied it. Then suddenly you get a second appeal and decide to pay. What gives? What changed? And two issues impacted the decision to reimburse the plan. One is that the plan administrator, the TPA, whoever it is that was making these decisions, it was the same entity making the same decisions over and over. So there was this question as to how could you make the decision one way and then flip the script later without justification, which leads us to the second issue. What's the justification? What changed? Explain why you changed your mind. And for whatever reason, whether it was that there was too many records and they all got jumbled together, it wasn't clear what had been submitted differently with the second appeal.
They could have actually just hired a good clinical review firm.
Yeah, they could have, right? And it has to do with the 25 pages, right?
Right.
The problem was
their mind.
They couldn't show why they had changed their mind. And so absent that, the stop loss relied on the first decision, then the decision to deny, and refused to honor the new decision overturning the denial.
Let me just guess. The next slide has Fia wearing a cape flying through the sky, and somehow we saved the day.
Didn't
Am I right?
The Incredibles, you're not supposed to wear a cape anymore. That,
oh,
you gotta get
capes.
Sucked into the airplane, right?
Okay. I've been watching a lot of stuff with my toddler, okay? Enough.
Whereas with the winner story, what ended up happening was, A, this plan, in this case, they were using the Fia group. But you're right, Adam. I mean, as long as you're using some sort of objective third party that they're doing this new review.
Preferably Fia group,
they
right?
Of course. They call it de novo, right? Sort of new
right.
review. What ended up happening was they were using Fia as the fiduciary decision maker on final appeals, which is great. But on top of all that, it also functioned as a third party decision maker. So by having us as a third party decision maker, one, there was a firewall between the final decision maker and those initial decision makers, so stop loss was able to see that it was reviewed de novo or with fresh eyes. And two, because this was the only time we were reviewing it on final appeal, all of the records, all of the data, all of the analysis, all of the claim review was specific to the final appeal and was documented exactly why the claim was deemed payable. So all of the mistaken information, all of the mistakes that were made the first couple times were removed. And stop loss was presented with a clean package showing why the claim is payable.
I'm not trying to put more commission dollars in Tim Callender's pay, but the reality is what people don't realize on the PACE product is, in my mind, the biggest benefit is when there is a stop loss problem, you turn it over to us and we handle it. That, to me, is a major, major plus of the PACE service. Sure, the fiduciary transfer, we're going to review the claim, fresh set of eyes, but at the end of the day, the stop loss carrier market respects us. They know that we're going to have an independent decision, and they know that we're professional in regards to our results, and that, I think, is one of the biggest benefits, that we will just take over that issue for you at that stage.
Couldn't agree with you more, Adam. And speaking of people,
use that, Tim.
Yes, there you go, Tim. You buy yourself some shoes. So speaking of people I couldn't agree with anymore, I'll turn it back over to Brady.
So we go from the Thomas the Train to a really good jazz title here, the Leave of Absence Blues. I like that a lot. We'll use that, I think, at some point on the podcast, maybe. But so
the jazz here.
It's
Brady.
Brady. Come on.
That's why he's still single.
At 1 o'clock as he's watching the game with the thumbs down.
Gotcha. Hey, Brady, go ahead.
Someone's got to watch it. So anyway, back to the stories here about handbook apps. This is something we see over and over again. I could literally go on for hours about the number of times we've seen this issue come back to burn plans. So I thought what we'd do in this case is talk about one of the more common problems we see with a gap between the employer handbook or other employer document and the plan document. So in this case, we have an employee diagnosed with a major illness. The employer grants 6 months leave of absence and continuous health plan coverage beyond FMLA, which remember is 12 weeks, and or an allowance in the plan doc, but didn't offer COBRA. In this case, the plan doc says something like general leave of absence in accord with the employer's policies. Right, that's probably what it says here. Large claims are incurred, they're received by the plan, they're paid per the network contract, and then they're submitted to stop loss. What could possibly go wrong, right? Well, turns out stop loss audits eligibility under the terms of the plan, and they determined that this person should not have been covered the last 3 months of that leave. The claims incurred, therefore, should not have been covered and were not reimbursable pursuant to the stop loss contract because the employee was not eligible after FMLA ended. So remember here, the important point is that stop-loss carriers are not underwriting your employee handbook. They're not underwriting other employer policies you may have posted. So when you send employees to HR to go have a review of their benefits and you're going through the handbook and they're told, yeah, we have a discretionary leave of absence we provide to you, you know, for medical illness or for whatever other reason you want, and we'll keep your health benefits going. If that's not in the plan document, if that is not detailed in the plan document, you're going to have this problem.
Remember, the stop-loss policy, when they say we mirror, means we mirror the plan, not mirror the handbook and the plan or the plan. It's a very important distinction. In addition, just so people know, I've said it before, 90%, 90, including our own handbook, has a gap between the handbook and the employee benefit plan. Why did that happen? How did it happen here at the FIA Group? Very simply, the people that draft the SPD is Jen McCormick and her team. The people that draft the handbook is Brady Bizarro, Sean Donnelly, and their team. Two different sets of people looking at the plan doc versus the employee handbook. They have HR involved, et cetera. There can be a lot of confusion. They need to match. So what we do every year in August, we do an internal review of our plan doc by one set of eyes, an internal review of our handbook by another set of eyes. And then in October, we, after the final docs on each, we then compare them to identify any gaps. I recommend you, your brokers, your HR teams, et cetera, and your consultants to do the same. Brady, keep going.
So I want to be clear on this point. It's not enough to say in your plan doc that, you know, to reference a policy. Some people think that, oh, what I mean here is that the plan doc says nothing at all about employer policies. No, it also has, it can't just say, please see the handbook, please see this policy. It literally has to say, this is our policy for, you know, here's a time limit established with the leave of absence. Here's whether or not we extend coverage. You need the details in the plan doc because a review of both documents in this case revealed there was leave of absence reference that would apply beyond FMLA and it would extend health plan coverage. And that should have been caught before. But because it was not, you have an employer who's now stuck with paying claims, and stop loss is most likely not going to play ball. You can try to negotiate with them, but odds are they underwrote one document and you had a gap, and that's not their problem. So if you have a case where the handbook and the SPD are reviewed side by side prior to underwriting and everything's gone on the same page, they both mirror each other, stop loss underwrites the document. If you have a match, that's good. You're going to have an employee who's eligible and whose claims are covered by the plan, and you should have no issue with reimbursement, at least with regard to a gap between the two documents.
So feel free to reach out to Brady for a leave of absence review or any type of gap review related to your stop loss, I mean, related to your plan doc and your employee handbook.
Great. Be happy to do it. All right, now back over to Jen.
All right.
Jen, it's the last one, right?
All right, that's it. All right, stop loss holding the purse.
Finish strong, Jen. Here we go.
All right. So in this case, the stop loss had an endorsement or a rider that said they would mirror the SPD, which is fantastic. Then, all of a sudden, surprise, the plan incurs a huge claim, $310,000. The deductible, the effective deductible here was $90,000. And in this case, of that $310,000 claim, turns out it actually was 1,230% of Medicare. Surprise. But what did the plan language say? It said that claims, in this case, UNC is defined as the prevailing rate in the area.
Hey, real quick, right there. So we've seen this recently, too, where one part of the plan says we're going to pay based on Medicare Plus, so we're going to pay based on Fair Health 80th percentile, or there is a really narrow, defined way of how we're going to pay the claim, which will reduce the overall cost of the claim. Everyone's a hero. Great job. But two paragraphs above it, or a paragraph below it, it says we're going to pay you whatever the normal charges are in the area. A contradiction. And as we all like to say, anytime two things contradict, a court is going to do what? They're going to rule in favor of the person who didn't draft the agreement.
Against the drafter. Right.
That's the point. I just saw that there, and I thought it was important to bring that up at that point.
Right. And so one of the things that we have seen over the couple of past years, I guess, where there have been those consistencies and inconsistencies as far as the language is concerned. We refer to the max allowable covered expense. We need to have one consistent definition. So in this case, that's what happened. The plan was mirrored, the stop loss policy was mirroring the plan. The plan said they were paying based on the prevailing rate. So the plan paid, and stop loss had no choice but to reimburse everything but what their deductible was, which was $90,000. However, this could have ended differently. How could this have ended differently? Well, if in this case, instead of immediately paying based on the prevailing rate in the area, which happens to be over 1,000% of Medicare, they could have reviewed the claim. They should have gone to us potentially to say, can you guys take a look at this claim? Is there any possibility of negotiating something so that this doesn't have to be so unreasonable? If they had, which they did in this case, they actually only had to pay $55,000. So that's saving the plan $35,000. They didn't have to get to their $90,000 deductible, and stop loss didn't have to reimburse anything, which helps to keep the cost down for next year when it comes to premiums. That was a really good choice for this group, and they were left with not having to even hit their deductible.
Great point, Jenna. I would add on to this only that if you do these kinds of things, make sure you get sign-off from the facility so that you're not getting pushback 2 or 3 years later with no stop loss coverage at the back end. Really quick, we have time for two questions. One I have here is, how do we as an industry force cost transparency? I mean, other than violence, I don't see any reason why we can actually force someone to do anything. All I can tell you is this. The only way to get more cost transparency is to do what we talked about 45 minutes ago. Do what FEA is doing with our employees. We're not forcing our employees to care about the overall cost of care. We're incentivizing them with money to want to do so. Are there still employees who don't take advantage of some of the cost-saving measures because for whatever reason they just don't care enough, or they're like Ron, they just make too much money, they don't really care about that, $2,000 or $20,000? Sure. But for the most part, people in our office care about cost transparency because they have a reason to do so. I hate the word transparency. I literally get vomit in the back of my throat whenever I hear a speaker talk about transparency or a politician because no one cares about transparency. No one's going to go to a website and look at all the different cost variables unless they have a reason to do so, meaning it's money coming out of their own pocket. If everyone could buy a Samsung 70-inch TV for a $20 copay, they would. But there's a reason why some of us have a 70-inch and others don't have a TV at all. They watch their TVs and Hulu on their laptops or on their iPhone. Is that what you do, Ron?
A little too much transparency, Adam.
Right. Sorry about that. Next question really quick. It says somebody asked, you know, we do a bunch of plan consulting work. We also create plan docs. Do we also do TPA work? No, we are not a TPA. There are hundreds of amazing TPAs in this industry. Sir or ma'am, it's a gentleman, if you want to reach out to us to get some information as to what TPA might be work well for you, there are great TPAs that know how to process claims in a great fashion. That is not something, though, what we do. Another question, last one, same guy, real quick. Why are more companies doing reference-based pricing? It's not easy. That's the easy answer to a not-so-easy question. It's just not easy to do so. So, real quick, guys, we're running out of time. For those of you who joined us, thank you so much for being here. Please join us for our next webinar, September 21. It'll be fall at 1 p.m. Eastern time. Feel free to visit us on feagroup.com to sign up. Also, don't forget about the podcast that we have every 2 weeks, and feel free to check out the 16 that we already have on there on Apple Podcasts. On behalf of Jen, Brady, Ron, and myself, thank you so much for spending an hour with us. We're humbled by the experience. Have a great rest of your week. Talk to you soon. Thank you.